The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thank you, Jim. It's always a pleasure to be here, and I never quite recognize my bio. How is the volume? If I speak at this level, is that okay? I see people nodding even in the outer hall, so that's great. Okay, thank you. So, at the end of a recent retreat at IMC's retreat center, the Insight Retreat Center down in Santa Cruz, a friend of mine who had sat the retreat came up to me with a little piece of feedback, and she said that she felt a little bit of anxiety that the showers were stocked with 3 bottles of shampoo and 3 bottles of conditioner. And it just felt like too much, basically, once her mind had been settled into retreat mode. Now, I'm not totally up on why there was so much shampoo and conditioner stocked in the showers there, but I suspect that it had to do with so that we definitely would not run out, right? And so I thought this was interesting, right? This fear of lack or fear of scarcity can lead to overdoing things or doing too much or stocking up too much or gathering and holding in. So today I want to talk about the notion of simplicity and sufficiency, these two. So sufficiency in particular. And this could be framed as the question, what is really needed here and now? What's really needed at this exact moment? So I find that there is great ease associated with living that has with an orientation toward sufficiency. So we can question in our lives how much of this too much dynamic is operating in our own life. For example, do you have 3 spare packages of coffee in the freezer so that you are absolutely certain that you have an ample supply at all times? I notice, for example, that I like those little Clif Kid bars. They're just right for a snack, and I find that I generally keep about 4 of them in the kitchen cabinet. And, you know, I'm never going to eat that many all at once. There's plenty of warning if I'm going to run out. But still, if I get below 4, I go and I buy a couple. It's very interesting. So I see this same mindset kind of operating in a subtle way. And then just look at a societal level, you know, in the American Western society that we live in here, we are way, way into the territory of too much. I guess we figure that if a little is good, then a lot is even better, not to mention safer. Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff in the world. I was just talking recently with a person who had been on FreeCycle. You guys know about that exchange site. And they were saying, you know, you could just supply your entire house off of FreeCycle. There's so much material abundance in this area that you know, people are dying to give away entire housefuls of furniture such that it wouldn't even be needed to go shopping. I'm not sure that we look at the cost of having so much stuff around. There's something we might call the suffering of quantity, right? And do any of us feel this? Do you ever look in your garage and just turn away and say, oh boy, I'll have to get to that someday? Maybe you don't, but I know a lot of people who have that phenomenon somewhere in their life. If it's not their garage, it's their basement or their computer files or their file cabinet or something. So an interesting question maybe for us as practitioners is how can we bring more awareness to what could be called the suffering of quantity? You know, how can we identify that in our life and see what's operating there in our mind? We can actually find through our meditation practice what is the source of that. So there is, you know, there is a cost to too much, and there's a cost to too little. So, you know, how can we find maybe a middle way? And that is maybe what I'm pointing toward with this notion of sufficiency. It's the right amount. Not too much, but not too little. So this question, what is really needed? So there are said to be four requisites or requirements for living as a human being. I don't know if this exactly captures them, but this is what it's said to be for monastics, at least, who are supposed to live very simply. And these four are food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. We probably have a few other things besides that in our life, but these are said to be what's really required for the basics of living, and these are the things that lay people are supposed to supply to monastics who have given up looking after these things in order to pursue Dharma practice full-time. But for us lay people, where we're supplying our own requisites, essentially, these become an excellent field of practice because we have some choice around these things, food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. And probably we're all aware that the messages we get from society generally are not very helpful around these things, right? We're told more is better. We're told it's about competition and making sure that yours is better than your neighbor's. And it's all about this too much. You know, if you need a little bit, probably a lot is better and it's probably safer. You should really stock up on these things. But the Buddha actually encouraged reflection around these four items in particular for both lay people and for monastics. And so one of the questions that he asked, interestingly, was, why do we eat? Why do we eat? Have you ever thought about that? So I'm actually going to ask that. I'd like some contributions. Why do we eat? To sustain the body. Yeah?
To avoid doing work.
There's some honesty. I like truthfulness. Yep. Anything else? Comfort.
Pleasure. Yeah.
Pleasure. Yeah.
To share a meal with
someone else. Connection.
To stop feeling hungry.
Very practical. Yep. These are all great. You know, what we're finding is that there are multiple things, right? So the further question we can bring is, how does wisdom, you know, how can wisdom inform some of these choices? Of course we have to eat. We have a body. The physical body is sustained by food. There's nothing wrong with eating. There's no, this is something that we're going to do for the rest of our lives. If we stop doing it, it's a problem. So this is definitely an area where we're going to keep doing it, so that means it's ripe for practice to be able to observe how and why and what's going on. The basic reason of why we eat is to keep our body alive and healthy. You know, it's a necessity to alleviate discomfort. Hunger is somewhat painful. And here's the wisdom part, the Buddha suggested, to enable us to continue on our path of inner development. You know, there's something, I think this is interesting, right, that there's something beyond the sustaining of the body. Yeah, we have to do it, but why not point the mind toward something useful and wholesome also? Oh, I'm sustaining my body in order that I can practice. I'm eating the right amount of food in order that my mindfulness is going to stay about at the right level. You know, if I get too hungry, it's actually hard to focus, hard to stay present. Too full, we know what happens then, right? Fall asleep or something else, also discomfort. So there's some wisdom around using this very basic practice of food to cultivate our practice. What a gift that this body gives us in that sense. So you can go quite far with the wise reflection around food. I've talked so far about the individual body that we have. But we could also think about the vast system that helps get the food to us. You know, there are the farmers, the pickers, the distributors, the grocery store, maybe even someone cooked it for us. There's the recipe which came somehow through human culture. Yeah? So this single simple act that we do every day could open up also the whole world of interdependence that we exist in our society. So there are multiple modes and ways of reflecting just around this, you know, this one requisite. When I think about the vast amount of energy that all of this takes and the suffering that it brings to some beings in order to make and supply food to me and to many people, I find that the sense of frivolousness around food disappears. It doesn't mean that I just want to eat the minimum amount of low-quality, bad-tasting, unnutritious food. You know, that's not helpful either. But it does mean that I bring a respect for the whole process and a desire to eat mainly what is sufficient and what is healthy. So I find that these simple reflections that the Buddha offered can really help to open up a very otherwise banal area of life, or an area where we're otherwise distracted by the pleasure, by the excitement, by the greed that may get caught up with it. So these are just some suggestions to consider around a very, you know, simple physical requirement. And we could do the same for our shelter, for our clothing. You know, what is it that we're bringing? Actually, there's a teacher at IRC right now named Dhamma Ruan. He's teaching a retreat there, and just yesterday he was talking about how we can ask ourselves for everything that we're involved in our life, what the connection is to enlightenment. And I thought, wow, you know, that's really quite dedicated to have that approach, and it's suddenly coming to mind in relation to this, you know, very basic thing around food. Surely we can find connections to ways that it can help us wake up, essentially. Can help us wake up to wisdom, it can help us wake up to interdependence, to compassion, to other good qualities. And he says that anything in your life, if you can't find a connection to awakening to it, then either you're doing something wrong and you should go ask a teacher, or it's not worth it, it's not valuable, so don't do it. Pretty interesting. What if we lived our life that way, really? What would you have to change in your life? Maybe a lot of things about your view, but maybe some things would actually go away also. It's an interesting reflection. I was encouraged and kind of motivated to really look at that more deeply. So sufficiency, we can also begin to investigate what's really needed in our mind. Yeah? So we've talked a little bit about the body. I know somebody who was on a retreat and was investigating thinking, because that's a good opportunity to notice thoughts arising and passing because you don't have quite as many of them. And she began to ask for each thought, is this thought necessary? Like the thought that just occurred, was that really necessary? And almost all the time, the answer was no. Now, this is not to demonize thought. Thoughts are going to happen anyway. It's what the brain does. But we can ask, do we need to have so many thoughts? And do we need to keep feeding the thoughts? You know, the thought will come into the mind, oh, I need to buy something before I get home. That might be a perfectly fine thought to have. Yes, you might need to do that. But then if it's followed by, you know, and I forgot that to buy it yesterday. I was supposed to do it yesterday, but I'm so stupid that I didn't remember it. And you know what? I've been forgetting more things lately. I wonder if I have early Alzheimer's going on. You know, and then pretty soon you're not even on the very practical, useful thought that you had earlier. And the mind has kind of gone off on its own story. So we can ask, is this necessary? Could it be that we could just live our life as a regular human without a lot of drama around all these things? So sufficiency, what's the sufficient amount of thinking and storytelling and analyzing and planning and so forth that we do? So if we're living in a complex world of thinking, calculating, and having anxiety about whether we're doing the best possible thing at each moment, this is probably not producing ease of mind. This is also an issue that Dharma practitioners run into, is the kind of extreme concern about whether what they're doing is dharmically correct at any moment, or is really the most wholesome, valuable thing that could be done at any moment. And this can actually end up tying us up in all kinds of thought and completely away from the realm of mindfulness, which is one of the best things you can be doing dharmically, is to be mindful. So, or to be applying mindfulness, noticing experience as it's unfolding. And running off on a thought trail so we've gone into the world of about, as Gil would say, about whether what we're doing is wholesome enough, dharmic enough, etc. Not especially helpful. It's probably not creating a healthy ecosystem in our mind for peaceful living. And then we're putting that energy back out into an already busy world. So what if we dared to put out a different energy, like contentment, calm, care, and easeful joy? So sufficient energy for what needs to happen, not more and not less. Back to the realm of food. I read a lovely quote that said, for some people, a cookie is just a cookie. And that's meant to contrast with those who look at the cookie and say, oh, I'd sure like to have that cookie. But instead of just picking it up, a cookie is just a cookie, it becomes, I don't know, is that really too much desire? Am I having too much desire for this cookie? Is that greed? Or is it just, no, I really need the cookie because I'm actually kind of hungry and then I might have low energy. Oh, but I'm going to have a sugar crash if I do that. And pretty soon it's not just a cookie anymore. It's become a whole worldview, really. So we have to be careful. Or here's another example. I was recently told that a class I was teaching was canceled. Moments before the class was beginning, I was told that the next week's class wasn't going to happen. And I had never been told this before. And I said, whoa. So I wrote to the person who set up the class and said, what's up? Why is my class being canceled next week? And I felt quite irritated about this. Like, this was very difficult to have to tell the class this, and inappropriate and so forth. But I refrained from expressing too much irritation. And I got a quick response and found out that it was because there was another teacher named Kim, and they had told the wrong Kim that her class was canceled, right? So they did what, you know, they did what they could on their end, and I did what I could to kind of clean that up. But I could feel my mind tending toward wanting to tell a whole story about this during the period where I didn't know what had happened. Oh, they're not respecting me and all of this. And then, but then my mind actually turned away from that. It realized, you know what, that's not going to be a helpful way of thinking. I saw the bigger picture. I saw that for my own ease, going into all of that was not necessary. It was not going to be helpful. And sure enough, it turned out that there was just this simple switch, and it was fine. So saved myself from suffering, saved her some suffering. This doesn't mean that we'll always turn away and just decide that, you know, it's all fine, it doesn't matter, I'm just going to wait and see. There may be times when we have to speak up or escalate things a bit more. But if we can't see clearly about that, then we don't have a choice. You know, then we're acting on, you know, just on habit, driven by emotions or underlying assumptions. So I know there's still a lot of work to do in my mind about having the sufficiency in terms of emotions and thoughts and responses and so forth. But I'm very happy to see and confident that the process works using mindfulness and good intention and right effort. I'm reminded that Albert Einstein said, we should make things as simple as possible, but not simpler. So I appreciate this because, you know, most of us start far on the complexity side, so we're working toward the making things as simple as possible. But it's, you know, it's not that we're trying to go so simple that we've become simpletons or that we don't take care of the things in our life that we need to. Most people do report that their minds become simpler through practice. I see a lot of this as the cultivation of contentment, which is a wonderful quality. Ajahn Sumedho says that the rarest quality in the world is not happiness, it's contentment. And it might be true, is that really feeling content with what we have and where we're at is a great treasure and a great gift that we can give to ourselves and to others. I also see this kind of practice, sufficiency practice, if you will, as a reduction of conceit, a possibility for reducing conceit. So we give up being what Philip Moffat calls the star of our own movie, which many of us are. It's a natural thing for the mind to see the world in terms of my story, how it's playing out, etc. But when there's less me in the way and it's not all about me and how much I can get and whether I have too much and whether I'm safe enough, then the heart is more open to developing compassion and helping others. This ties in directly to the teachings of the Buddha. So consider, for example, the opening lines of the Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. So I find this quite beautiful. To me, it describes a simple, peaceful, ethical way of living and being in the world. Now, getting there is going to mean letting go of gross material concerns, for sure. So frugal in their ways, for example. But also letting go of the dramas of hate and desire in the mind. So, you know, unburdened with duties, you know, not caught up in all the thinking and the planning. It doesn't necessarily mean that we don't have any duties. It just means that we're not burdened by them. Yeah, so it's fine to retain the duties that you have, but can we live in a way that we're not burdened by them? Simplicity and sufficiency can actually go pretty far. Consider these lines from T.S. Eliot. Quick now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. So what if we were to let go of everything? I'm feeling in a certain way like this is a sufficient amount of words on this topic. And I want to pause here, actually, and hear from some of you some reflections or questions about this notion of sufficiency or about bringing simplicity to life, challenges of doing so, insights that you've had through your practice of reducing the complexity. Yeah, we have a microphone. Did you have one, Anne, first? Okay.
I was caught by what you said about the cookie thing.
Yeah.
And how a lot of times a cookie's just not a cookie anymore. It's a huge story. And I have noticed at times when I can see that, that there is a spaciousness that I don't know what to do with. It's like I'm uncomfortable with the spaciousness, the simplicity that you're talking about, when those moments when I can achieve it, that spaciousness is kind of foreign to me.
Interesting.
And so I want to fill it up with more story.
Yeah, so you've noticed the habitual momentum of the mind toward filling space. Have you had times when the space didn't get filled?
Yes.
Yeah. And what did that feel like?
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's worth noticing that feeling. And you can trust that your heart is learning from that to find that in other ways.
And it's usually when I'm sitting outside in an open, spacious field of my neighbors where I spend a lot of time.
Uh-huh. So you're supported by the surroundings.
Yes.
Thank you for sharing that.
I was thinking of the paradox somewhat in simplifying stuff, the garage, or I had a four-drawer lateral file cabinet that... Yes, I wanted to simplify it, but it would take a lot of complexity to go through it.
Yeah.
And it did. I got a auto feed scanner and scanned stuff and threw out gobs of stuff. But it took a summer. So you know, I think there's somewhat of a, yeah, we want things to be simpler, but we have to go over this mountain to get there that is not simple.
Yeah.
And that adds a complexity.
Yeah, it also brings to mind the notion of prevention. You know, once we see. So, but you're right. Is that there's a lot of wisdom there in noticing that when we've already accumulated a certain amount, then there becomes this burden associated with it, sort of an accumulated frozen burden in that. Yeah, and I know what you mean about that complexity being unpleasant. I'm in the process of moving, and I'm organizing some things, and definitely I watch my mind doing that. Yeah.
I guess this is kind of adding on to what the first lady said, but one of the things that comes to mind is I like to read a lot, and I have a collection of books, and there's probably about 25-30% of them that I haven't read, but I have them. And it's interesting because if I see a book that looks interesting to me, there's like an excitement that comes, and I want to get that book, even though I have a lot of books I haven't even read already. And there's something to that, and I have also had an experience of more of a peaceful, tranquil mind state, but there's something about that excitement. It's almost as if that peaceful state is very, very subtle, and there's something that seems sometimes a little bit boring about it, and there's some excitement about getting something new that kind of tends to win out sometimes. And then I have another thing in my home that's cluttering up the place to deal with. So
yeah,
it's interesting.
Good observation. I'm reminded of a story that Gil tells where he said that he used to like to go to bookstores, but he would always be tired coming out of them, and he couldn't figure out why for a long time until he realized that he had desire for everything in the store. And it was just tiring to go through that much desire for an hour looking through the store. Over here, I saw you first.
Okay. Speaking of sufficiency, I've noticed this in family members. There is redundancy, and it's as if something is said, and they have to fill up the space by saying it another way or again.
Mm-hmm.
Or the teachers do this a lot. They repeat themselves. And that's that's not very sufficient. But it's almost as if to fill up the space and make your point. And I've really learned, I think I used to do that, that you really only need to say it once. And all this extra finagling is either to control someone by repeating it over and over and over. And that has something to do with the sufficiency, I believe.
Does your mind feel more at ease when you're interacting in that way of just saying things once as needed?
Well, I work with young children. It sometimes has to be a couple times.
Yeah, okay.
But, yeah, especially talking to an adult.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so you've noticed that your speech pattern has changed through becoming aware of what's useful in speech.
You know, yeah, because I know I abhor when this is drilled into me, kind of like a parent to a child. And that's not correct to do, I realize now.
Yeah, I'm pointing you toward the feeling of ease or simplicity that comes through the mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can, you know, you may be aware that it's unpleasant when other people behave in a different way. That's also one more thing to notice.
That's what's been
happening.
Thank
you for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to hi,
is this on?
Okay. So I found that when my life is very, very simple, like it is now, that it causes me to do a lot more self-reflection and mm-hmm. get to know myself more. I recently moved to the Bay Area. I left a lot of just about everything behind, my furniture, my belongings, and moving here with, you know, not really knowing anybody, and then discovering myself a little bit every day and kind of walking with myself and realizing what I like and what I don't like. So it's been a very insightful type of journey for me.
So you're referring to the spaciousness that opens up from having a simpler, more open life. Yeah? That's what I'm hearing. Beautiful. And have you learned any insightful things about your intentions and motivations? You ended up here. It's not bad.
Yeah,
I'm just curious if you...
There's definitely worse places I could be.
Yeah. Well, that's lovely. Well, you're smiling as you say that, so it sounds good. There's one over here.
Thank you for the topic. It's really interesting to me. I've been less and less peaceful about the less and less water situation. And it's forced a lot of letting go of things that are precious to me that I've really worked on making beautiful, like my lawn, and also the delicious hot showers I love to take. And things like what I like to do is, you know, I like laundry, and what's clean to me now is just like, well, this is clean enough, and this can be dirtier, and so it's a lot of like this way of life that I never thought I'd have to think twice about. And of course you go, so how much is enough water? And of course I'll always have enough water, but so many trees are dying and it's not enough water for so many things I love. And I just am having a hard time acknowledging that everything changes and, you know, opening my hands to that catastrophe. And I know we don't need to call it a catastrophe. You know, it's reality. But right now, as a Californian, I feel it's a catastrophe. And even as a practicing meditator, it leaks into my thoughts so often.
Mm.
It's like, I'm desperate for peace around it. But, you know, I don't know what enoughness is when it comes to...
Okay, let me pick up a few points that I'm hearing. First of all, thank you for sharing this obvious, you know, this clear concern and in a pretty heartfelt way. And what I hear is that you're, as a practitioner, this external situation with the water is actually helping your heart to open in certain ways. Can I say that? I don't mean to interpret, but I hear, you know, the sense that you're modifying your behaviors, you're starting to question your relationship to change. This is an excellent practice. And in a way, you're turning this into your practice, into a way to open your heart. It's quite beautiful, actually. You sound a little distressed by it, but I want to point out the beauty
in it. I could see
it
could be beautiful. I could see from that.
Yeah.
You know, it's noble, and I can see that, but right now it feels like...
Yeah.
You know, is this my last spring for my garden?
Thank you.
Jim? Well, I was struck by what the man... over there said about books and that wanting. For me, it's easy to have spiritual wanting. I know so many people who are going on really wonderful retreats, retreats that are full, right? And Dharma books and things like that. I'd say more recently than I would like, I think I've really been noticing that what's really helpful is just taking in delight in the experiences of other Dharma practitioners. You know, like hearing about the retreats that they've sat and some of the insights they've had, and just, and some of it isn't even verbal, you know, just kind of like getting kind of a nonverbal sense of what, you know, transmission of what they got. And then, having friends that read voraciously so that I don't have to read all of the books. You know, so kind of
we
getting me...
We can't read all the books.
you can't read all the books. So this is sort of the Reader's Digest version. But, you know, personalized by... Yeah. So I think for me that's the road to contentment is more with the mudita aspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it isn't that one has to have these things, but it's the sharing of the joy that really has been helpful for me to ease, you know, to let go of those thoughts of having to have it all in a spiritual way.
Yeah, that's beautiful, and the joy is unlimited, so it's always sufficient in a way. Can't be too much. Yeah, in the back there.
I'm not sure if this is morbid or just a natural thought, but when you said at the end of your talk, what would it be like to let go of everything, the first thing that came to my mind was, well, eventually we're all going to have to let go of everything. And, you know... maybe for some of us it will be more gradual. But sometime between now and the end of my life, I will have to let go of all of the material things in the world.
Thank you. That's a lot of wisdom right there. And it's not at all morbid. Yeah, you guys, you may notice right now, actually, everyone in this room, what do you feel about that comment? I saw a lot of nods while you were making that. Yeah. One more here. And then it's just about 9 o'clock. Can somebody? Yeah.
I haven't been here in about a month, and I noticed when I first came back from being very busy and very excited being in a new city, I was in Vienna for my husband's work. That was really good. But then I noticed, and this is happening a lot, is that my mind, the spinning around, the stories and all that, have come back. And when I started here in June and I was meditating every day, I seemed to be free of all that talk and that circling around stuff or wishing I was somewhere else. And so I realized the importance of meditating and being more grounded. But I just wanted to share that I was with my aunt as she was dying. It was my first experience, really, of being with someone for 6 days and holding their hand while their eyes were shut, their mouth was open, no speech, just breath. They were breathing. And when I was with her, I did a lot of metta and also meditation. And I felt really good that I was giving her the gift of life. I mean, the gift of presence. And I guess that really felt good. And watching her slip away seemed like I kept telling her it's okay to let go. But one thing about her, I mean, one of the strongest feature characteristics of her throughout life was shopping and accumulating jewelry and clothing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she was a fashion designer, and her husband had a fur store. I mean, they were always accumulating jewelry, antiques, and clothing. And there were closets filled with clothes, fur coats, and all this stuff. And in the end, I convinced them to bury her in a white shroud. Well, it's a white silk. It's something very beautiful that the Jewish tradition does. But it seemed like all this clutching onto things, and she wore like 7 layers of necklaces, but she was very pretty, but felt she needed to do that, and then suddenly it was all gone. Just
yeah,
the contrast.
This is a wise reflection for us in our own lives, huh?
Right. That yeah. In her case, it took death to somehow get to a place of total simplicity. I mean, it's not a good way to do it, but it it just was this. I mean,
well,
she was 92. Also, if it was,
you're pointing
if she was,
toward important things. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to process all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing it. Yeah. All right, I think we'll wind up. Thank you for all the wonderful comments and wisdom. It's really important that we share these things with each other. Thank you.